This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Mark Jacobson is here today to tell us about his paper titled Review of Solutions to Global Warming, Air Pollution, and Energy Security, published in 2009 in the journal Energy and Environmental Science. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your paper, Review of Solutions to Global Warming, Air Pollution, and Energy Security? What is your goal?
Well, I've been working for about 19 years examining the causes and effects of global warming and air pollution. And also in the last 10 years, looking at solutions to global warming and proposed solutions and their impacts on the atmosphere and on climate. And this was really the culmination of many years of work where we had looked at all sorts of energy sources and their impacts. And I wanted to gather all that information in one place, particularly at this point because many people had been proposing all sorts of solutions to climate change and energy security. And I wanted to evaluate which ones were good and which ones were bad. And I had the ability, and our group had the ability, to evaluate this because we'd been working on this area for quite some time.
Which energy sources did you evaluate?
Well, we looked at both electric power sources and vehicle options. I mean, if we look at what causes air pollution and climate change, it's mostly fossil fuel combustion today, but there are really three main areas. There are power plants, there are vehicles, and there's also industry that creates a lot of pollution. And we actually focused in this case on power plants and vehicles. So we looked at different type of electric power sources that could replace current power sources. The new ones would include wind energy, solar energy, geothermal, tidal, wave power, and we looked at people's proposals for nuclear power, hydroelectric power, and coal with carbon capture and sequestration. But also we wanted to look at vehicle sources of pollution and how to replace those. So we looked at the future vehicle types, including corn ethanol and cellulosic ethanol. Then we looked at battery electric vehicles, where the electricity for the battery electrics would be used from any one of those electricity options I just mentioned. And finally, we looked at hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, where the hydrogen was produced by electricity from those same electricity options. So with that, we were able to compare across all the vehicles. We can compare battery electric vehicles, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, and ethanol vehicles, where the power is actually produced by a variety of sources. But we could put the electric power sources and the liquid fuel options on an equal footing.
What criteria did you use to evaluate each of the energy sources?
Well, for each energy source, we looked at 11 different side effects. And some of these side effects were environmental, some were kind of reliability and availability of the resource. So, for example, we looked at the potential for each either electric source option or vehicle option to produce greenhouse gases, so that affects global warming. We looked at their impacts on air pollution and air pollution health, particularly death rates. We looked at water supply, the effects on water supply of each option. We looked at the footprint on the ground, how much physical land each option took up. And we looked at the spacing required because some options like wind energy or tidal energy, they take a certain amount of footprint, but then they require more space between them. So you reduce the interference, let's say, of one wind turbine with another, so you need space between them. So we looked at the spacing. We looked at the effects on water contamination. We looked at the effects on the reliability, how reliable was each energy supply or vehicle option. And we looked at the available resources. Is there enough sun? Is there enough wind, et cetera, to power each one on a large scale? We looked at impacts on terrorism. Is there a big risk or small risk of terrorism associated with each option? So these are the major things we looked at, plus a few other ones.
How did you weight the different criteria?
We felt the most important criteria were the impacts on global warming and on air pollution health. And so those two were given the greatest weight. because, well, first of all, if you look at the from fossil fuels today, worldwide about 2.5 million people die from air pollution. So clearly this is a very important issue. It's one of the 6 or 7 leading causes of death worldwide. So this is a very important. And then climate change, of course, is a very important issue that we all know is going to affect things in the future even more, although the impacts are already being felt today. Then the other things that were weighted heavily were the effect on the footprint on the ground, because the actual physical land that's taken up by each energy source affects wildlife significantly, and it also affects the ability to use that land for other purposes. It affects scenery and also affects a lot of other things indirectly. And water consumption was weighted pretty heavily. Another thing is the reliability of each energy source was given a pretty moderate to high weight. There was a lot of thought that went into the weighting, and we looked at the sensitivity of the weighting to changes in the assumptions about the weightings. And it turned out in the end, after the weightings were done and the evaluation was done, and we tried just doing some of what are called sensitivities where we arbitrarily changed the weighting by several percent, it turned out that these changes in the weightings didn't really matter a whole lot. I mean, if you didn't change them a huge amount, it turned out that the results were so clear in terms of what was good and what was medium and what was bad that moderate changes in the weightings really didn't have an impact on the results.
Which energy sources came out on top based on your evaluation?
Well, the number one result was that in terms of the electric power options, wind energy was at the top, but it was closely followed by what's called concentrated solar power. We looked at two types of solar power. There's concentrated solar power, which is really mirrors heating a fluid, and then the fluid heats up, and you use the heat to create steam to run a turbine to create electricity. So right now, for example, there are these concentrated solar plants. There are a few. There are about 3 in California that have been operating for many years that not a whole lot of people know about, but they're very, very effective. So the concentrated solar was number 2. Geothermal power came out number 3. Number 4 was, well, there's tidal power and wave power were very good, and also photovoltaics were in between there. So photovoltaics, which are the stuff that you usually see on your roof, turned out to be pretty good as well. So those are the kind of the best options. Then the middle options were hydropower and then nuclear power and then coal with carbon capture. Now, of those 3, hydropower was the best of those middle ones. And it was recommended, even though, I mean, the other ones that I mentioned at first were the ones that you'd want to use by far the most. And hydropower, although it was in the middle, it was also recommended because it's such a good load balancer. It was actually very clean in terms of its carbon emissions and its air pollution emissions. But its disadvantage was it took up a huge amount of area, and it had a lot of water evaporation because you have a lot of surface area. Whenever you have a dam and water behind the dam, there's a lot of evaporation, so you have a loss of water supply there. Although dams obviously have dual purposes of producing water supply. But it was recommended because there's a very good what's called load balancer, because some of the good options like wind and solar, they're what you call intermittent. And like the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine. But it turns out by combining wind and solar together in the electric grid with geothermal, for example, then you can smooth out supply of energy. So you can actually match the demand for energy hour by hour during the day a lot better, but there's still some gaps. And because you can turn hydroelectric power on and off so quickly, within 15 to 20 seconds, basically, you can release water and create power. That is such a good load balancer to really smooth out the supply of electricity during the day that was recommended. Nuclear power and coal with carbon capture. Well, nuclear, for example, in the end produces about 25 times more carbon and air pollution than does wind energy. And coal with carbon capture produces about 60 to 100 times more. And because of these disadvantages, those weren't recommended. And it's primarily not only because of their relatively higher emissions. I mean, they are better than the liquid fuels, such as ethanol, but they're not as good as these other ones that I mentioned, the wind, solar, and geothermal, tidal, and wave power in particular. But you don't need them because there's plenty of resource available, of particularly wind and solar, that you can power the entire world many times over for all energy with these resources. And so the real question with nuclear, for example, becomes, well, why would you need to add nuclear when it's producing more carbon and when you don't need to? And it also, one of the big risks with nuclear is the enhanced proliferation of weapons that results from the spreading of nuclear energy facilities worldwide. And just to give a quick example of that, Pakistan and India, their nuclear weapons programs were started clandestinely from their nuclear energy program. So the West sold Pakistan and India nuclear energy plants, basically, or all the technology for nuclear energy plants. And as a result, then Pakistan and India both went on to secretly refine uranium for producing nuclear weapons. So this is historically, we've seen worldwide that many of the nuclear weapon states, or those that want to be nuclear weapon states, they start with nuclear energy programs. So there is this link between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. So there's a bigger risk for the transfer of nuclear weapons technologies due to nuclear energy. So that's one of the major reasons why you don't want to expand nuclear energy on a large scale. Because even if you just did it in the United States, where supposedly things are more secure, well, how much can you do that before all the other countries start demanding to have their own nuclear energy facilities? So you don't want nuclear energy to be a large-scale solution to global warming and air pollution. And finally, the worst options that we looked at were corn ethanol and cellulosic ethanol. These were the worst in just about every category in terms of the air pollution death rates, in terms of the carbon emissions, the net carbon emission, in terms of the land use required. I mean, you basically need 15% of the entire United States to run all the vehicles on corn ethanol, and that includes Alaska, 15% of the entire United States. Water requirements of ethanol are humongous. Just about every category, both of them were bad.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Our topic is his paper, Review of Solutions to Global Warming, Air Pollution, and Energy Security. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle and on the web at kexp.org. Why is cellulosic ethanol worse than corn ethanol?
Okay, so cellulosic ethanol, it's supposed to be what's kind of like a second-generation ethanol. It's supposed to be an improvement over corn ethanol. And in some respects, it is. Well, cellulosic ethanol, I mean, there are many ways to produce cellulosic ethanol, but if you wanted to do it on a large scale, one of the proposals has been to use like prairie grass. And so the use of cellulosic ethanol reduces, in theory, the amount of carbon compared to corn ethanol. But just to put it in perspective, with wind, for example, if you use wind to run battery electric vehicles, that would reduce greater than 99% of the total carbon emissions from the combination compared to gasoline vehicles today. You'd reduce more than 99%, 99.7%, if you use wind energy to power battery electric vehicles. Now, if you did the same thing, replacing gasoline vehicles with ethanol vehicles run on corn, you would either have no change in the carbon. When I say no change in the carbon, this is based on what's called the life cycle analysis of the carbon, where you look at the production of the corn, all the tractors going into producing corn, the transport of the corn, the production of the fuel in a factory, an ethanol factory, the distribution of the fuel to the stations, and the combustion of the fuel in a vehicle. So that's the whole life cycle. When you analyze that, and you also have to look at the fertilizers and things like that. When you analyze that, then there's anywhere from no change in the carbon due to corn ethanol to the most recent analysis that actually accounted for land use changes as well, found that there's up to a 90% increase in the carbon compared to gasoline. So for corn ethanol, you could have no change or to 90% increase in carbon. Cellulosic ethanol, it's a little bit better in terms of carbon. It's maybe a 50% reduction, but the highest estimates based on land use change, accounting for land use change as well, are 50% increase. So take the median, it's really no change. The median value between a 50% decrease and a 50% increase is no change. But regardless, that's much worse than wind energy, which is reducing the carbon by over 99.5%. But in terms of the air pollution, it turns out that cellulosic ethanol actually puts out more than corn ethanol, and both put out more than gasoline, because the life cycle estimates that we're talking about really are just for carbon, which is not carbon dioxide in particular. It doesn't have the same impact on air pollution as a lot of other chemicals coming out of the production of these fuels and the use of these fuels. So just the burning of ethanol in your vehicle produces about the same or more air pollution as burning of gasoline. It doesn't matter if it's from cellulosic ethanol or corn ethanol. But it turns out cellulosic ethanol has greater emissions in the production of the cellulosic ethanol than does corn ethanol, and greater emissions of air pollutants that are not carbon. And so it turns out in terms of the death rates due to health, air pollution health, you get a slightly more air pollution death rate due to cellulosic ethanol than corn. The other thing is the most recent studies on the amount of land area you'd need for cellulosic ethanol from prairie grass shows that you would need even more land for cellulosic ethanol than for corn ethanol. In fact, the upper limit is up to 35% of the entire United States to power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet on cellulosic ethanol, compared to the upper limit for corn ethanol is around 20%. So those are the two main things that caused cellulosic ethanol to be slightly worse than corn ethanol.
So your results indicate that wind energy is the most promising in terms of all of the criterion. For the purposes of discussion, if we converted all of our current electrical use to wind energy, obviously we're not going to do that, but for the purposes of discussion, what would be then the likely effect on global warming?
Well, if you converted all our energy sources to wind energy in some form or another, you would eliminate the problem of global warming. You would eliminate 2.5 million air pollution deaths worldwide. And you get a similar result if you did this with concentrated solar power. But let me give you an example of, well, how feasible is it? Well, let's focus on the United States vehicle fleet. In the United States, about 33% of all the carbon emissions are associated with vehicles. So to reduce one-third of all the carbon, and therefore pretty much, because the air pollution is pretty proportional to that, one-third of all the air pollution deaths, which in the United States are about 50 to 100,000 per year. People die per year prematurely from air pollution. You could power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet on wind with between 73,000 and 144,000 5-megawatt wind turbines operating in wind speeds that are between 7 and 8.5 meters per second. Now, the footprint on the ground, because wind turbines are just a pole sticking into the ground, basically, or they could be over water, but the footprint of that number of turbines is between around 1 to 3 square kilometers. So you could power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet with 1 to 3 square kilometers of land physically taken up.
And what percent of the U.S. land is that?
Well, it's so small, it's in a very small decimal place, but let me just give you another number first. Because of the spacing, you need to space wind turbines apart, so you can't just space them right next to each other, so just to take up that 1 to 3 square kilometers. They have to be spaced so they don't interfere with each other, and that would require about 0.5% of the land for the spacing, which is about one-third the size of North Dakota. And that would also be 30 times less land than is needed for corn ethanol. But remember, in the case of corn ethanol, that's taking up all the land physically, whereas the wind turbine spacing, it's not taking up the land physically except for up to 3 square kilometers. All the land between the wind turbines can be used for agriculture, open space, wildlife habitat, rangeland, or other purposes. So, I mean, this is really a small land-consuming technology. Just to compare it to nuclear, to do the same thing, you would need to power all the vehicles with nuclear in the United States. You'd need about 275-850 megawatt nuclear power plants to do the whole thing. And that would take up a footprint space about the size of Rhode Island compared to 3 square kilometers footprint on the ground for wind. So in World War II, the United States produced over 300,000 airplanes in the space of 7 years, with most of them in the last 3 years of the war. And so we're talking about almost around 100,000 5-megawatt wind turbines to power the entire vehicle fleet. I mean, this is very feasible. And the amount of wind we have in the U.S. is huge. I mean, we have winds that are fast enough to do this job over 15% of the land of the U.S. So we only need 0.5% of the land for spacing of the turbines, and we have 15% available for wind energy. So we can power the whole U.S. multiple times over if we really put our mind to it.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Our topic is his paper titled Review of Solutions to Global Warming, Air Pollution, and Energy Security. You alluded to this earlier, but just briefly, how can we deal with the problem of intermittency with wind energy?
Well, there are multiple ways to deal with intermittency, and it hasn't actually been demonstrated to be a problem because we've never had a high penetration of wind in the U.S. So it's really theoretical that it's a problem. But if you just have one wind farm in one location, it will be a problem because, you know, the wind might blow one day, it might not the next, even minute by minute. But it turns out, and we've shown this with data, and so many other people have shown this with data as well, that when you interconnect wind farms that are geographically dispersed, in other words, far from each other, but not that far, even just a few hundred kilometers to maybe 500 kilometers, when you interconnect them, you smooth out the supply. And so you can get a smoother result, and there's less intermittency. But with that concept, it turns out when you combine wind with solar, wind often peaks at night, and solar peaks during the day. So they complement each other, and they smooth each other out as well. And you can put them in the right proportions to actually match the power demand. And then you add on top of that geothermal. Well, geothermal is like a baseload power, so it's more flat in terms of the power supply curve. But then you add hydroelectric power, which you can turn on and off instantaneously to fill in the gaps. And we've shown that for California, and this would apply to the whole West Coast because the whole West Coast of the U.S. has lots of hydroelectric power. I mean, Washington has huge amounts of hydroelectric power, that when you combine wind, solar, and hydro in particular, you can generate an absolutely demand-matching power supply. So you can meet every hour of the day. And so there is no problem with intermittency when you are smart about it and you think through of how to solve the problem. There's another way to do it when you have battery electric vehicles. Battery electric vehicles, or even hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Well, battery electric vehicles would generally be charged at night if you plug them into your garage. Now, the utility can then provide you with that electric power at any time during the night. So it doesn't mean you don't need instantaneously produce power. It could be just aggregated over a certain period. And with hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, it's even more solvable because hydrogen can be stored over a long time, over a year. So you just need to generate the hydrogen any time during a year from wind. So it doesn't really matter when the wind's blowing. And that's just a storage place for the energy. And then you use the hydrogen in your vehicle. So there are many solutions because right now what happens is you have these natural gas peaker plants that are turned on and off to fill in the gaps. And so right now there's a problem with intermittency of the current electric generation sources. That's why we have these natural gas peaker plants. So in the worst case, we're not doing anything more than what we're currently doing. But if we're really smart about it, we can eliminate this problem of intermittency when we use these renewables.
Based on the analysis in your paper, what is your recommendation for public policy? What advice would you give to the Obama administration?
Well, the first thing is that we need to focus on the good solutions to global warming and air pollution. And those good solutions are pretty clear because after finishing this evaluation, it wasn't like there was really close between what was good and what was medium and what was bad. It was clear that wind, concentrated solar, geothermal, tidal power, wave power, photovoltaics were excellent solutions to this problem, and you could do this on a large scale. So we want to keep our eye on the ball, focus on the things that cause large reductions in the emissions. There's no reason to focus on things that are risky, either in terms of war, such as nuclear energy, and in case of nuclear also doesn't use the carbon or air pollution as much as people have thought, and also coal with carbon capture, which actually doesn't exist at any scale right now or in any real power plants. and people are speculating about how beneficial it would be. But even when you capture the coal, it still has the problems that you're still mining the coal, and that takes up a lot of energy and carbon, and you're transporting it, and you still have emissions from the carbon capture, and you require 25% more energy for the equipment. So it's really not a solution to this problem. And then the liquid fuels option we know are just horrendous in terms of, I mean, they don't do anything compared to gasoline today to improve the situation.
That's the corn ethanol and the cellulosic.
Corn and cellulosic. I mean, there's no proof that they've had any beneficial impact on carbon or air pollution. In fact, all the evidence suggests otherwise so far. So we want to focus on things that we know can reduce huge amounts of carbon up to 99.5% or more. And there's plenty of these resources in the United States and worldwide, and so there really is no reason not to focus on them. So the philosophy in the past has been, let's try a little bit of everything, hopefully something will work, and that's got to change. I mean, the problem is too serious, because we need to reduce 80% or more of the total carbon emissions and air pollution emissions to solve the problem of global warming. And this 80% reduction can only occur if we use these real renewables, not these kind of what are the middle solutions or the ones that we know are bad, because there's a limited pie of funding, there's a limited amount of time, and we don't have time to experiment with all these technologies that are uncertain when we have existing technologies that we know that work and that will solve the problem.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think I want to leave on an optimistic note, say there is a solution to this problem of global warming and the problem of air pollution health. There is a solution, but it requires focusing, keeping an eye on the ball. If the Betamax had been pushed as much as some of these other options, Betamax was technology long ago that lost out to the VHS recorder and then DVDs. You know, if people had invested more in that, and they would have wasted their time. So we shouldn't waste our time with things like ethanol. We shouldn't waste our time with nuclear or coal with carbon capture, because these are just not solutions to global warming on a large scale. And I would really like to focus on the things that we know are good solutions and that we know that will solve the problem.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Mark.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
We have just been speaking with Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. For more information, check on the web at news-service.stanford.edu/news/January 7th and click on the link for December 10th. Again, news-service.stanford.edu/news/January 7th and click on the link for December 10th. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.